Okay. Welcome back to the programme. We are talking now to two guests, Emma Gova. We've spoken to before, of course. Emma, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Thanks so much for calling in. And today we're speaking also to Michaela. Good morning, Michaela. Thank you for joining us.
Hello.
It's great to have you with us. Thank you. I think it's the first time we've spoken. Thanks so much for coming in and helping us raise awareness of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Emma, have the pronunciation okay there?
You do, yes.
Okay. Right. What is it?
It's a series of inherited connective tissue disorders. So there's like 13 different subtypes. But basically it means that the person is born with a defective collagen gene. And as we know, collagen, or for anybody that doesn't know, collagen is extremely important. It's like the glue that holds your body together. It's important for your bone structure, your organ structure, your skin structure. It's literally important to every aspect of your physical being. Some people have hypermobility Ehlers-Danlos, which only affects their joints. Some people, like Michaela, have classical Ehlers-Danlos, where it affects the joints, the skin and the organs. And some people have vascular Ehlers-Danlos, which would be a rarer type, but they would be the most three that are talked about. And people with vascular Ehlers-Danlos, it is their vascular system that is affected by it. So as I said, Michaela has the classical Ehlers-Danlos.
And is it hereditary?
It's genetic.
It's genetic.
It's
yes,
genetic.
Sorry, that's the better way of describing
it. If you have Ehlers-Danlos yourself, and your partner has Ehlers-Danlos, then obviously there's a much higher chance that your child will have it. You could also, though, not have Ehlers-Danlos, like myself and Michaela's father. We don't have Ehlers-Danlos, but when our genes mix, there's a 50-50% chance that you can have a child with Ehlers-Danlos.
And that really comes, you really learn that after the fact, obviously,
yes,
don't you?
Because nobody else in our family had ever had it. So it was more that, so it was quite, it's quite a rare condition as well. Mm-hmm. We're learning more and more about it. I think it's for the type that Michaela has, it's 1 in 10,000. But if you have one child with it, and like us, you're more likely to have another child with it. So we mm-hmm. have two children with mm-hmm. this condition. We have two children who don't have it. So it's kind of a Russian roulette kind of thing. You can have a child with it, or you might not have, you could both be carriers and not have any children with it.
Yeah.
Or you could, all your children could have it, or maybe just one child.
Yeah,
have it, just
there's
depends.
A predictability to it,
but there's a predictability.
There's a randomness to it,
yes.
Also, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Michaela, you're 19 now. You were first diagnosed at 11. But did you realise before that there was something that needed looking at?
I was always a sick kid, but I think when you're a naive kid, you don't really understand how complex the problem is. I just knew that there was something different about me that wasn't the same as other kids. I would go into school with like a king of hearts on me, but like I didn't think too much about it. Mm. I just knew that like there was something strange with my heart. I was going into doctors a lot, but I didn't really know things like conditions. I knew I had epilepsy because I took medication for it, but I didn't understand the complexities of medical conditions and disabilities because I was so young.
Yeah, of course. Can you Emma described how it affects you, but maybe in your own words, just, you know, when we talk about affecting your skin, your joints, your organs, as much as you're comfortable talking about, as always, Michaela, but how would you define it affecting you?
Well, I can get, I tend to get multiple dislocations a day. What joints tend to dislocate tend to vary, but usually it's my shoulders, thumbs, knees, but it can be other joints as well. My skin is more fragile than other people's, so it cuts, bruises more than other people's would. I have hyperlipidemia a lot.
What's that? Sorry,
Michael. You don't have hyperlipidemia, you get confused.
Oh, no, not hyperlipidemia. The other thing, the wrong thing, the thing I got yesterday.
Well, we can come back to that.
She gets like brain fog. Is it
kinda, that's another thing that starts with H, but that I get under my skin. But it starts with H.
So like she can get hypertrophic scarring.
Yeah.
So when her skin tears, when it heals, it looks like cigarette paper. Okay. As if you were rolling a cigarette.
Yes, yes.
It's quite shiny and silver.
I get you. Michaela, the dislocations, you speak so casually about it.
I suppose it could be
my knee, it could be my shoulder. I mean, at this point, do you use as a family, can you pop that stuff back in? Is that something that you need assistance with?
Oh, yeah, we can. Because at a certain point, we were told, you can't keep coming up to the hospital with this. I remember at one year, we were going up so much that, like, we were told, like, This kid could get sick. They're getting too much radiation from these X-rays.
Yeah, I get you.
So we were getting told, like, this is how you put it in yourself. Mm. It doesn't, like, always work. So we were getting told methods, like, just lie down and try again later. But otherwise, you know, like, you just kind of got to deal with it in your own ways. We were told a variety of different methods to put certain joints in.
And I suppose, too, once you're sort of empowered or advised to do it yourself, you're probably learning all the time what works best with what particular area, or, you know, if it's a shoulder or what have you. But does that then make you nervous? Do you know what I mean? To do stuff for yourself? Because you probably want to, you know, push yourself on and be as independent as you possibly can be. But do you have this fear that if I do this action, it might result in that, and that, does that hold you back, or do you fight through it, or what way do you describe it yourself?
It really depends on what the thing is, but from my point of view, like, it depends how big the action is. Like, I was told a while ago, like, people were hesitant to take me on holiday, and I was saying, like, if I was always this hesitant to go on trips, like, or do big things because of risk of injury, like, I'll never go anywhere.
Yeah, what a brilliant attitude.
But, like, if it's smaller things that I know will probably get me hurt, I try and find other ways around it.
So, in practical terms, and you make the call on it, you don't want this condition, this syndrome, to hold you back?
Yeah, I'd say so. I definitely have aspirations and goals that I want to do. I intend to go to art school. I want to be an artist. I intend to work in character design and storyboarding. Probably get into shows and work for animation.
Fantastic.
You're big into travel.
Yeah.
So in terms of the progression, Michaela, is this where you're at now for the rest of your adult life? Is there any concerns that things might worsen for you? What way does Ehlers-Danlos syndrome progress?
It definitely worries me in terms of, like, it definitely worries me, like, often. Like, you know, you have a progressive disease, you're always worrying all the time. Like, things might not be like this forever. Like, because you think, like, when, you know, I was a kid walking around, now I'm suddenly in a wheelchair. Yeah. I'm not able to do things I used to be able to do. While, you know, my siblings are out doing things that they're enjoying.
Yeah.
But in terms of how it progresses, I think my mom would be a lot more eloquent in speaking of that.
Okay, I wasn't ignoring your mother. I just find it quite fascinating to hear directly from you. And there's one other, not one other thing, but I want to ask something else too, is that you have a very positive outlook, even though, you know, for a lot of people listening, they might say there's an awful lot going against you. But in terms of your determination to do things, even if there's a little bit of a risk there, your determination to pursue your love of art and what have you. I mean, it must be difficult to stay positive all the time, but certainly in the way you speak now, you try and be as positive as possible.
I wouldn't necessarily say that I'm always very positive. I definitely say I'm more of a realist than anything. I definitely have my tough days. But I suppose, like, I've gotten help for a lot of my problems. I definitely encourage a lot of other people to do that as well. But, like, I suppose my determination stems from my family's stubbornness as well. So I think that's a big aspect of it. I have been told in the past, you know, maybe you should try something a little less risky and probably because of my stubbornness, it makes me want to do it even more.
The opposite happens.
Yeah.
Okay. So Emma, in terms of treatments, or obviously when things are incredibly rare, two things happen. A, we have to try and raise awareness, don't we? Because it's important people know. But B, sometimes maybe investment in financial or time in research can be lacking compared to other conditions. Set the stall out for us how that is.
Well, one of the professors in England, whose name now escapes
me, he's retired.
He was saying that Ehlers-Danlos is probably one of the most underinvested conditions across the world. And it's actually quite hard to get a diagnosis of Ehlers-Danlos. You know, even though it's a genetic condition, people tend not to get diagnosed until they're in their teens. It would be a positive if they're diagnosed. Some of them don't get diagnosed till they're in their 20s. Mm-hmm. It depends on the type of Ehlers-Danlos they have.
How quickly it onsets.
Okay. It was just when Michaela was diagnosed, we were at that stage where it was like, we know that there's something wrong. She had collapsed in school. We knew there was something wrong. We just didn't know what it was. Mm. And it was a South African doctor who was locum and who first said to us, Ehlers-Danlos. And he said the problem now is finding what we call a diagnostician.
Mm.
So that is a doctor who specialises in diagnosing rare conditions. And so we travelled down to Cork because there is no specialist for Ehlers-Danlos. And the waiting list for rheumatology for children, my own daughter's still on the list. She was put on it in 2018.
Wow.
She's never seen the rheumatologist. She'll age out, so we took her privately.
Yeah.
So because of that, we went privately with Michaela, because when we rang up and she had been referred, we were told the waiting list for genetics and the waiting list for rheumatology was years.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew we were dealing with something, and we had to know what it was in order to deal with it.
Yeah.
So when she was diagnosed, then came the hard blow that you now have your diagnosis, but there is no cure. There is only.
Is there any therapeutics? Anything that can?
All they can do is manage the symptoms.
Yes.
And some people respond well to that. Unfortunately for Michaela, she had another underlying condition with her muscles,
mm-hmm.
which meant that the intense physiotherapy she did to strengthen the muscles to do what the ligaments couldn't didn't work.
Yeah. Did you want to say something, Michaela?
Oh, I was going to say, I think a good example of differences in EDS is how, like physiotherapy was very different between me and my sibling.
Yeah.
Mm. Because I had an underlying condition, none of it worked for me.
Yeah, I get you.
I ended up getting told by a physiotherapist, everything we've tried isn't really working. So they gave me a ton of things to deal with pain, breathing exercises and stuff like that. But my other sibling is still in a physio routine that is working for her.
Yeah.
So because she doesn't have the same underlying condition as me, but she does have EDS.
She's still able to walk.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I'd rather it did work for her than it didn't.
I know. But that's your attitude, your positive attitude.
Yeah, positive.
Yeah.
And you know, I remember when I was chatting to her yesterday about coming on today, and I'm going to drop you in it now, she said to me, don't dare say I'm inspirational on the radio, because she hates to be called it. Because it was just something that struck, looked like she's getting all embarrassed, but it was something that struck me with her. Because she said to me, I'm no more inspirational than the next person. And I said to her, she said, this is my problem. This is my thing to carry.
Yeah.
I'm carrying it. But that doesn't mean and she gave me a great example. She said, for example, see somebody who owns a defective concrete blockhouse. Their problem is real to them.
It's relative, isn't it?
It's relative. That's exactly what it is. It's relative to who you are.
Mm.
And the thing is, I'm no more inspirational than that person who'd have to tumble their house.
Well, Michaela batted off me calling a positive, so I avoided that. So I didn't want
to. She doesn't like it because she'll say to me,
been doing this a while, so I get the signs.
Somebody said to her one day, you're so inspirational. And she said, you make it sound like I have a choice. this is my condition.
Yes, but, the thing about someone, the thing about whether someone is seen as inspirational or not is you don't really own that. It's kind of we own that, right? If we find you inspirational, that's an us emotion.
I definitely
said that. So you don't have to worry about it.
I definitely said that to my mom. I did say to her, I'm not going to tell anyone who's listening to this, don't call me this, don't call me that.
I get you.
I'm telling my story, and objectively, you can take away from it what
exactly,
you want.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the social norms of it, you tend to find that people who are very ill or in a wheelchair will get stopped in the street when doing nothing. Like, they could be buying an ice cream or something, and they'll be stopped and be told, you're so inspirational. When someone beside them could be struggling or homeless or in a defective house.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Well, their struggles are just as real as mine, and the person who just called me inspirational will continue to walk past them.
But that being said, Michaela, if it helps, you know, like, there, I've spoken to a lot of people affected by defective concrete, and the strength that they show, I find inspirational as well. So, you know, it's a lovely thing for someone to describe you of. I think I'm a little bit, maybe me and you are somewhat similar, is I don't really like being talked about, or I'm not really, don't take praise very well. So I think it's more of that. So we'll agree to disagree, Sharon, if that's all right. Yeah. Who wins the arguments, Emma?
Oh, 100% she does. 100%. I said that to my husband the other day. I said, you know, Michaela could actually argue with you that black is blue.
Yeah.
She could, and she always has to have the last word.
Yeah, but it's articulate, so debating team.
Yeah, I think my husband said to me then, he kind of, he was on the phone at work, and he kind of, we were video calling, and he said, you know what's wrong with you is that you're shouting and demur, the two of you are the copy of each other.
The apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. What do we want to come? I mean, obviously we're in Ehlers-Danlos Syndrome Awareness Month, and we're talking about it, right, and that's all good in the hood, but what needs to be done, what can be done?
Well, as we know, there's no specialist centre in Ireland, and we were actually talking a little bit in the car that, you know, Michaela still has to travel abroad for treatment.
Yeah.
We did talk about that, didn't we?
Yeah.
And, you know, simply because the scan that she needs isn't...
Simply not here,
and you know, they try and put what they call multidisciplinary teams together, but the issue with that is, when somebody is in paediatrics, the team comes around you, and that's fantastic. It is, and I can't fault the team that we had when you were in, and you know, we went to Harold's Cross and the rheumatic musculoskeletal disease unit for intense physiotherapy and things. But then once the person ages out and goes into adult services, it all becomes primary care again.
It's the cliff edge
and,
job, isn't it?
And it's like you fall off the end of a cliff, and you yourself are sourcing these things.
Unfortunately, that's a pattern.
And that's a pattern. And for people who have Ehlers-Danlos or other conditions like that that are lifelong and chronic, and who have this, like, the struggles that Michaela have, like, for example, when Michaela wakes up in the morning, whatever side she's been lying on is dislocated.
Yeah.
Mm. And, you know, she and I don't know, like, she'll say to me, I don't know how she's not screaming the place down. No. I don't know whether she's become used to it. I don't know if you can become used to it.
But you have, I mean, you have to keep on keeping on, though, don't
you?
I mean, I know that's easy for me to say, but I mean,
you know, I had said that.
You have
in
a choice to make, don't you?
Yeah,
Michaela?
We said that in the car and the
else. You either keep going forward or you give in, and you choose to keep going forward.
Yeah, either you keep pushing forward or you just stagnate.
Yeah, No, I get it. But still, it's hard. It's hard. When you're not affected by it, it's just very hard to put yourself into that mindset.
I think
walk a week in my shoes sort of a thing.
Yeah, I think trying to raise awareness, you know, like, we know people who we've met through support groups, and there's a girl at the moment, and she's now spending her ninth month in hospital because of not being able to get support.
Do we have an idea outside of your family how many might be affected in Donegal?
I think my two children, and then there's a family with a mother who has it, and two of her children, because she has it, and then one other person that I know of.
I was going to say, my brother knows someone who has
it. Yeah. I think there may be, from what we know of maybe 10 people in the entire Donegal.
Well, I can't remember exactly, because we talk about lots of different things. It will come to me, it just won't happen right now. We were talking about to a gentleman who had a condition, and he was of the view that there was 3 in Donegal or something along those lines. Can't remember the exact figure. And after the interview, we got contact from way more than that.
Yes.
So people don't know other people are in the same boat and stuff. Yeah. Is there a support group or something? Or where would you direct people who've listened to this that want a little bit more information?
There is online, because I suppose it is rare.
Yeah.
Trying to get everybody into a room. But by all means, I need to stress this. I didn't start the support group. I just joined it. There is the Hypermobility Spectrum Disorder and Ehlers-Danlos Syndrome group for parents and family members,
mm-hmm.
and for people affected by it on Facebook.
Yeah.
And then there is the Ehlers-Danlos Society of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there is Rare Disease Ireland, which people would reach out to as well. And then, you know what, as Michaela always has this saying, you know, find your tribe. You know, Michaela would say to me, you know, somebody doesn't have to have Ehlers-Danlos. It can be another rare thing, and they just know we're on the same boat.
To get people together.
And then
last word, Michaela.
I'm not really. Good.
That's a good sign. You know, that means I've done a decent job.
But I will say, thanks to your show, I definitely got a lot of help with getting help to get that scan in London. So thank you very much for that, and if that person is listening, thank you to them as well.
I didn't want to reference that, but it was a very moving thing, Emma, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
Sometimes you need to know there's people out there that care, and they a virtual hug around you and your family, and that's what.
Well,
that
if
was,
that person is listening, and I know you won't mind me saying this, if you had have seen her face that day when I went in and said, "You're getting the scan." And that person is covering the actual travel and accommodation as well. And if you had a... And I'm getting a bit emotional about thinking about it because I was thinking about her that day. And she just was like, what? And I told her, and she just said, you know, she kind of looked at me for a minute. She was like, what? And I said to her, I get it. She was like...
I couldn't even cry. I was just...
She was like, I don't even know where to put this. I don't know what to say. And then she said to me... I remember, and I know you won't mind me saying it because we have talked about this to her. She gave me a big hug, and she said to me, she was sitting in her bed, and she gave me a hug, and she said to me, thank God, because I don't want to die.
Yeah.
And that was just, that person literally gave her a chance. And that was the one thing she kept coming back to the day. This person's given me a chance, mummy, a real chance. And they know that I have a progressive disease, but they think I'm worth something.
Well, when you listen to Michaela, you have to back. You have to back you. All right, listen, thanks so much for calling up. I do appreciate it. Was it okay? It wasn't that bad, was it? No. Oh, I don't like that answer. I'm cutting your mic. Go on. Emma, say something positive. No, I'm joking. Come here. Thank you both very, very much. It's been lovely to meet you, Michaela. Great to have you back on the show, Emma, and love to all the family. And again, a big thank you to that person who was listening the last time, and you've heard there the difference that's made to Michaela, but it means an awful lot to the people around the person as well.
Absolutely.
Because it just... It's hard to actually put into words or which box to put that motion in, but it's just something else.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's just a great sign of humanity out there. Emma, Michaela, thank you so much. Again, thank you so much to Michaela and Emma for coming up and chatting to us. And I think, you know, obviously, I'm getting used to this radio stuff. Not everyone does it all of the time, and it's just amazing to see people come on and tell their story. It's fantastic, and hopefully it helps. Has anyone noticed that businesses are leaning towards cash-only payments? I was just getting used to using cards due to COVID, and now we're back to cash again. Many businesses say that the only reason they're able to survive is the use of cash. Maybe someone in business can break down... it costs quite a lot of money to lodge cash, and then, of course, there is a charge on the card payments. I think, really, the best business gives you the option of both. Greg, I live in the Lifford area. I don't have a letterbox. Last night, I had the girls in bed at around 9:45. A candidate's people opened the front door and dropped leaflets in. I was shocked at the time of night they were still out and that somebody would open my front door uninvited and do this. Is there not a cut-off time for candidates to call to people's doors? I mean, maybe slightly over-enthusiastic there. Probably not the best thing to do. Hi, regarding the lady, or it could have been a gentleman. Hi, regarding the lady and the €2 each per week for four children, this is very reasonable. She gets 560 a month children's allowance, so I think 64 a month for training is great. And I disagree with discounts for over three siblings. Why do the parents that have one or two children always have to pay full whack for everything? Yet, if you've three or more children, you pay less, but you get more on children's allowance than a parent that has one or two. I'm not saying that this listener is not aware of this, but there is an awful lot of people in this county in particular, and those listening, that say they get their payments or their wages, whatever it might be, on a Thursday, that on Tuesday evening, maybe Monday evening, there's no money left, that they have to make do with stuff that's in the fridge or in the freezer and cobble something together to feed everybody, that they go to the petrol station and have to put the minimum in, €8, €10 into the tank just to get the kids to and from school or something. Like, and there's a lot of people live life like that. I've lived my life like that. I'm not far ahead of it now, but I've lived my life like that, whereby your money comes on a Thursday or Friday and you're out of money on a Monday or a Tuesday. In the past, you could do a post-dated check or hope the check wasn't cashed until the Thursday or Friday, or that the money would be in at that stage, but then you're always chasing it. So I get exactly what you're saying, and I get the maths, and what you're saying is right. But for some people, that, you know, that €8, they actually simply don't have it. Right. Read the posters. Two callers have made the point that in their area, they notice that there are candidates putting posters on every single poll, not 2 feet apart in some cases. No need to have so many posters up. It's an absolute disgrace. Another sick of their old mugs looking down on every post possible. In a completely unconnected move, I now go to Councillor Paul Canning. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Have you your mug looking down on many people?
Not yet, but getting there.
What's the reaction on the doorsteps like? I suppose particularly as a government rep, Paul.
I think, no, I'll tell you what it is. The people are only, we've been out the last few weeks, and because there was no posters up, there was nobody really interacting with you. Yeah. Said, oh, when's the election? You know, so far now they're starting to, you know, it gives it a wee bit of a charisma, maybe, or a wee bit of, you know, jizz about the thing, you know. So that's the only thing I would say, and that's the only reason they're going up, you know, because what happened is people says, oh, you're not running in my area, I don't see your poster up. So
it's a catch 22. But I think really, and whilst it is 4 weeks, I think really we're heading into the 2.5/3 weeks where things intensify, you know, lots of debates. Lots of meetings, lots of calling at doors and stuff. All right, that's not why we invited you on, just interested in your insight. Now, members of the A5 committee from the North West travel to Leinster House this week to meet with Transport Minister Eamon Ryan. I'm pretty interested in what he had to say about the TEN-T road project. I interviewed him when he first got that portfolio. He said, yeah, he knows about it. Yeah, he wants to fund it. And even the Bonnegie link is not part of the TEN-T, is it? But it is sort of, the TEN-T has to progress for the Bonnegie link to progress. But what was the, we'll talk about the A5 in the end too, but what was said about the TEN-T at this stage, please, Paul?
Yeah, I was actually surprised that he was so up for it, you know what I mean, and very enthusiastic about it, because the situation with the whole TEN-T, but he actually spoke about the TEN-T more than he actually spoke about the A5. And was very optimistic about where it was going. But you see, there was a councillor from every county on the full A5 N2 link, you know. So he spoke about the TEN-T and how he's looking forward to the TEN-T, how he wants to promote the TEN-T, and he wants to support the TEN-T. So our focus yesterday was on we're still awaiting the close out of the two reviews to allow us to progress it to the cabinet. So that's where we were at. So the two reviews, one was a business case by the Department of Transport, and the other review is for the public expenditure and the National Development Plan. So we were looking for a time frame for the completion of them reviews and when they would get approval for Cabinet. So, you know, the Minister, in fairness to him, confirmed that these reviews would be completed within the next couple of weeks, mm-hmm. and they'd be brought before the Cabinet for approval in July, before the summer recess. So that'll allow us to move on to phase four.
Yeah, what does that mean, in terms of approvals and phases and all that type of stuff?
I'll give you a quick rundown for a layman's term. You've stated that the TEN-T is the road network. It consists of the Lifford to Manor roundabout, the Balbuffet bypass, and then it goes on to the Bonnegie link. So the complete scheme has to go through what they call four phases, right? The first phase is what they call the study area, preliminary options assessment, they call it. So that just gets you a study area of the whole county where these are going to be. And then you go into so that first phase has been done. You go into a second phase, right? And that's what they call the project appraisal of the route option. So they look at certain routes and then what they come up with as an emerging preferred route. So that has been done. The preferred route has been chosen. So that was the second phase. And we that's gone through and that's approved and all of that. We are now in the third phase, which is the design stage for each section of that route. And that gets what they call an environmental evaluation and if it stacks up financially. So that's the approval that we are waiting on. That is with the department. So we're waiting on that to allow us to go to phase four. Now, phase four then, that consists of a complete environmental impact assessment for the entire project, plus the documentation, along with all the CPO documentation. And that then, after that happens, right, we then are sent to Mbord Pleanála for an oral hearing. And following that, if you get a positive decision to proceed with the project, we go out then for tender for a contractor and construction will take place. But, you know, there is a warning with the environmental impact assessment because there's a lot of work involved in that because you have a floods impact, you have the displacement of habitat, you have to replace the habitat that you're displacing at another area, you have mitigation, you know, and them impacts then, first of all, it's what happens during construction, after construction, yeah. How the road impacts on the whole area, you know, so all of that. And then you're onto with the CPO situation, you need legal documents, who owns what, and all of that has to go through. So it's a slow burner. And when it comes to that assessment, that's my opinion on it. You know what I mean? But we
do
need
you think
to
there's
get
an
to
argument? There's
point.
A conversation happening at the moment, and I'm not endorsing it, but or otherwise, whereby we are that there's an argument to progress the development of onshore wind to sort of waiver some of the EU environmental impact stuff. Do you think there's an argument for similar when we're talking about pieces of critical roads infrastructure? It's too late maybe for this project. But
There is an argument for that, but it's taking it to the minister of the Green Party is not the place for me to bring that up. Like, but no, there is an argument definitely for that because I think we're giving too much protection to the habitat that can the habitat can move its location, etc., etc. I think we have too much emphasis on the protection of certain habitats. Now there is habitats that needs to be protected, but there's other habitats that. The same habitat exists further down the road, you know, and I think we need to start looking at, you know, the displacement and the replacement of it, you know.
Right. Okay. So just to be clear then, the project will hopefully move to stage four. Minister Eamon Ryan believes it will be approved before cabinet in a matter of weeks. It'll be interesting to see
correct.
If it's before
that
the elections
correct.
Or not,
yep.
But anyway, probably not. So at
no,
that point, what happens then in phase four? I know you'd layman's termed it, but it'll come up time and time again, and I just really want to be clear where we're at. So phase four
what happens then? Going back again, so what happens then when they approve it at cabinet, right? That is us closing the third phase. We're closed. That's us then approved and passed phase three. We then have to go then, and the start of phase four, we have to complete the environmental impact assessment for the entire project.
Uh-huh.
We also then have to document that, and then we have to start CPO in certain areas. And then it becomes the land ownership, and maybe people haven't got their own house in order insofar as you're buying land that you don't know who the owner is, and all of that has to come into play. So there is a lot of work involved in that aspect, and there will be soils. We have to seem to be protecting the water. We have to be as protecting property that this doesn't create flood. All of that assessment has to be done. And it's slow because I'm in the middle of the as I say, the Burnfoot bypass, or not the Burnfoot bypass, but the Burnfoot to the flood scenario with them. And it's very slow with them assessments. Mm-hmm. This is going to be the same.
Yeah, okay, right. I might be flying
and then
up that
after,
road
then
to a
after that
car,
assessment,
then.
Yeah, Yeah, but after that assessment then and after the CPO, then it goes to Inbord Pleanála, right? And the Inbord Pleanála then, there's the oral hearing, and if they give you the right, the okay, then we go out to tender and out for a contractor, and then you're starting construction.
Right, it's baby steps, but look, we have to recognise one phase is concluded, even if we've still a long way to go. For now, Councillor Paul Canning, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Right, take care of yourself. 086 60 25,000 WhatsApp and texts. Again, it's just one of those things. I'm staying optimistic and positive, but my breath will not be held. Michael said he isn't putting up posters for the environment. This is Michael McBride yesterday. But he then prints out 3 leaflets to put in each household doorstep. His poster money is being used to print out these leaflets, so he isn't saving the environment. Again, Michael did reference the fact that it can take hundreds of years for and this is just his view, for these posters to biodegrade. Those leaflets could be printed on recycled paper and go straight into your recycle bin. I don't know, I'm just playing devil's advocate. So maybe they're not quite the same. Another caller says, what about the stuff coming through the post? It's a disgrace. A lot of people not huge fans of that. Hi, Greg. I utterly condemn the people who took down and burnt the posters of local election candidate Adrian McMillar in Buncrana. You just wonder what's going through people's minds in doing that. Maybe we should bring up, this is to do with GEA football before we go to our next guest. Maybe we should bring in financial fair play rules. Otherwise, we'll be chasing the Dubs' investment levels forever. It's meant to be amateur. I think on a level playing field nationally, we would have even better chance. There'll be some scramble for tickets for Bala Buffet now again. Up Donegal, says the listener. Yep, indeed. I think you're right. Okay, Rose is with me now. Rose, good morning to you. Thanks for taking the call.
Good morning, Greg. You're welcome.
We were talking to Emma and Michaela a little earlier on, and you were highlighting the fact that your family has a condition called HSP 7. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, HSP 7 is a genetic condition. All these genetic conditions come from a faulty gene, which has to be in both the mother and the father's side. And it would mimic, to a certain extent, Parkinson's, but you don't have the tremor. But it affects your mobility. Now, out of our family, there's 10 in my family, and out of the 10 of us, there's 5 of us have been diagnosed with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the 5 people that have it, now, to me at the moment, to a lesser extent, thankfully, but I have 2 sisters and 2 brothers with it, and it affects your mobility, and what happens is your legs feel heavy.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can't lift them properly, so you're inclined to trip over things.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had a few falls. I've had a few through the, and that's really, I just got the genetic test done because I just wanted to see if I had it or not. And but thankfully, I'm not too bad, but you could get progressively worse with it, you know.
Yeah, and I suppose there's that uncertainty, isn't there, Rose? You never know which step is the one where your leg doesn't respond to the signal from the brain.
Yes, exactly.
You've described it as not life-threatening, but certainly life-changing.
It's life-changing because it doesn't actually take your life, but now, I don't read up about it too much because it would actually frighten you if you read up about it. Because they give you the worst scenario. And but so far with our family, it's affected our mobility. And, you know, they've got a gait when they're walking. And now there's one sister in particular now, she would spend time in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. So it would be definitely life-changing. And we're under Mr. Murphy now, and he actually says we're very high rate because normally it's 20% out of a family, and in our family there's 50%.
Mm-hmm. And Rose, in terms of then it being a genetic condition, is there any risk of passing it on to children, or has that risk happened with the combination of your parents' genes?
No, well, it can't be passed on. Now, say, for example, you know, the people especially that haven't been diagnosed with it, they're carriers.
Mm-hmm.
So if they meet, their partner has the same faulty gene, that can be passed on to their children as well.
Okay.
But now I don't have any family, so like I won't be passing it on or anything. But
theoretically, Rose, if that was in your plans, a prospective partner theoretically could have a blood test to determine the risk, in case they were a silent carrier or something. Hypothetically, I mean, Rose, obviously I'm talking about your private life, but that you could check the risk in advance.
You could probably check the risk in advance. Now, but now I have two of my sister's partners have had the test on.
Mm.
So they can kind of, their children can be relieved, you know.
Yeah, I get you.
So,
of course,
and they've been okay in that, but it is quite rare in the country. And the funny thing about it is five of our family that had the red hair have got it.
Right.
But they do say, now that they say it's nothing to do with hair colour, I think it's the strongest gene.
Mm-hmm.
Within your family. So there's another family that we know of who have the same condition.
Yes.
And two of them have red hair and two of them have dark hair, and mm-hmm. two with the dark hair that have got it.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, yeah. Yeah, there's a pattern, but a randomness. Okay. Well, Rose, I suspect, dependent on the severity of it, there might be people around listening with HSP7, and maybe the penny might drop following our conversation. Because it sounds to a little bit like it could be quite difficult to diagnose if you weren't pointing your GP or your consultant in the right direction. But Rose, thank you very much for helping us spread awareness. I do appreciate it.
That's no problem at all, Greg. And, a lot of people are being treated for Parkinson's and different things, and maybe that's what they've got all the time, HSP7.
There you go. It could happen. Okay, Rose, thank you. Simon Chambers is director of Much Ado About Dying. I had to double check my script here because I nearly confused it with, I presume is the play on words of Much Ado About Nothing. Good morning, Simon. How are you keeping?
Hi, Greg. Great to be on the show with you.
No, it's lovely to have you on the programme. And we're speaking ahead of a special screening in Letterkenny and Century Cinemas of Much Ado About Dying. It's on Sunday, the 19th of May. And there's a Q&A at 6:30 with Simon. And also in attendance, also there will be screenings in cinemas in Derry and Buncrana. So how do you describe your film, Much Ado About Dying, Simon?
Well, it's really a film about me coming home, being called back from India, where I was living, to come and look after my exuberant actor uncle in London. And that's the reason why it's called Much Ado About Dying, because he loved Shakespeare. And at any opportunity, he'd start to sort of jump into different Shakespeare characters in everyday life. And so there are so many carers around, family carers, who are really undervalued and taken for granted. So it's a celebration of them. But it's a very, very funny film because Uncle David was such a character.
So the film, tell us how the story is told then. Are you filming whilst in your uncle's company and so on?
That's right. It's me behind the camera because I am a filmmaker. And it was really him saying, you know, you better get your camera out and start filming me. I'm an actor, for God's sake. You're missing a trick here. And so I was filming all the ups and downs. And some of the things, for example, you know, old people can get a little lonely. And so it was just very funny because whenever he had to go to the hospital, he'd absolutely love it. He'd love all the attention, people coming and saying, do you want a cup of tea? Do you want some jelly with some rhubarb and custard? And, oh, my God, it's like a 4-star hotel here. A lot of the questions around looking after people. So, for example, he didn't want to go into an old people's care home over my dead body.
But then, and were you able to have these conversations with him as part of this? Because that will be really relatable and not something, those exchanges and those views being expressed and teased out, not often documented, really, I don't think.
Well, that's what I didn't realise until I'd finished the film, Greg, is that we had all these people coming to see the film. It's been going around the world at festivals, and it's won about 9 awards. And people are saying, oh my God, nobody's really talked about this story before. You're talking about me and what I'm doing. I'm looking after granny, or I'm looking after mum or dad. And it's got all the things in it that happen, you know, when you are looking after an older person.
To some extent too, Simon, obviously this is about carers, but also about the person being cared for. I wonder sometimes maybe too, if their story's not fully told, that they're often fun, vibrant people who do require care, of course, and may be aware that their time on this earth is not as long as they might want it to be. And maybe they're sort of, I don't viewed as past, or not contributing anything, or not the vibrant, funny people that we all know and love.
Yes, I think you've got a point there. And one of the things I found out when I was doing my research is that, you know, people, when they get older, I mean, obviously they have health problems and all of that sort of thing. Your energy levels are not the same. I already feel like that now. But but the thing is that some of them say they're incredibly content. You know, if you have enough money and you have heating and all of that, it can be a very, very rewarding time of your life because you're not caught up with the hamster wheel of everyday work and life.
It's another strand to this too, sharing your uncle with the world.
Very definitely, because he had an incredibly inspiring attitude towards life and death as well. And in fact, you know, just in the film, before he's sort of on, when he's on his way out, really, he's singing the hot chocolate song, "I Believe in Miracles, You Sexy Thing," and, you know, singing "I Will Survive" in an ironic kind of way.
So he was fully aware of the situation, and I don't mean that in terms of, I don't mean terms that in terms of mental capacity. I'm on about actually just in terms of the reality of the situation.
Oh yeah, very much, definitely. You know, he saw life as death as a very integral part of life, and really believed that in, you know, it's something that's going to happen to most of us. So we need to sort of accept it more and embrace it.
And over what period of time were you able to film with your uncle, Simon?
Well, I filmed all over the whole of the time when he called me back from...
How long was that, though? Like,
and it was 5 years.
Oh, because wow.
I thought I'd just be coming home to sort out all his problems, then go back to India again. But as many people who are family carers will know, you know, you think it's just going to be a couple of weeks while granny's leg gets better, and then 10 years have passed and she's still living with you. So it's like that with me and David.
Of course. And I mean, you've proportionately, percentage-wise, dedicated a great deal of your life, actually, off the back of this call or, you know, this would you. You know, 5 years of anyone's life is a significant chunk of it. Now, I'm not saying you regret that in any way, shape or form, but it is a huge part of your life too.
You know what? At the time, it was the last thing I wanted to do in the world.
Yeah.
But then I've actually realized that time I spent with him, I got so much from that. Mm. And in a way, I don't think there's anything that better that you can do with your life.
No,
than
I agree.
Care
yeah.
People and be kind to them. I mean, making films and winning awards in festivals is nothing compared to actually looking after the people that you love. And sometimes the people you want to strangle, but you still love them.
I know what some might see as a nightmare actually is for many or most a gift and so, an experience they wouldn't want taken from them. So obviously then the Much Ado About Dying is being screened in Letterkenny in Century Cinemas. Not wishing to direct the questioning in any way, shape or form, but I presume it's not your first Q&A. What path do they tend to go down? What, having watched the film, what are people most inclined to ask?
Well, we have the most fabulous Q&As after all the screenings, and the audience are incredibly engaged, and lots of people want to just talk about their own experiences of caring. Lots of people want to talk about how they feel about dying and death and getting old, and it really turns into much more of a discussion between the audience and me, rather than, you know, chin stroking in a chair talking about how did you make the film.
Okay,
so it's a lovely sort of conversation that everybody tends to get involved in.
And just very briefly, Simon, has it changed your attitude to life and death?
Oh, very definitely. Okay. And I think when you see the film, you will see that.
Okay, brilliant.
It's very definitely. Yes.
Right, we won't provide any spoilers then. So listen, thank you very much, Simon. I'll tell people how to book tickets and stuff in a moment. But for you, for now, thank you.
That's lovely. Thanks,
Take care.
Greg.
Bye-bye, lovely. Simon. That's Simon Chambers there. And you can get onto Century Cinemas, their website, for more information on that show, which is on Sunday, the 19th of May. Have a wonderful day, everyone.